from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. A new warning of terrorism cast a shadow over America today and over American politics. At FBI headquarters in Washington, Attorney General John Ashcroft and FBI Director Robert Mueller announced that law enforcement authorities have credible intelligence from multiple sources that Al-Qaeda is planning to attack the United States this summer or early fall.
Credible intelligence from multiple sources indicates that Al-Qaeda plans to attempt an attack on the United States in the next few months. Several upcoming events over the next few months may suggest especially attractive targets for such an Al-Qaeda attack. These events include the G8 summit hosted by the United States in Georgia, the Democratic Party convention in Boston this summer, or the Republican Party convention in New York City.
Ashcroft went on to say that the terrorist plans are, by their own public reckoning, 90% complete. But when such an attack might happen, or how, or where, is still unknown. It's a big, horrible what if. What if Al-Qaeda attacks in this presidential election season? What if a Madrid-style bombing should happen at conventions in Boston or New York City? What impact would it have on the race for the White House tonight on Point? Terror alarms and the November elections, the calculus and politics of a potential catastrophe. We go first to Washington and today's warning from Attorney General John Ashcroft and FBI Director Robert Mueller. Josh Meyer covers intelligence for the Los Angeles Times. I asked him why Ashcroft and Mueller decided to issue this warning now.
Well, that's a good question. We're always sort of left wondering why they do things and when they do them. Unlike other warnings, this one does not seem to be driven by any kind of particular or alarming intelligence, more of a drumbeat of general concerns, I would have to say. I think Ashcroft did allude to intelligence that he said was public, in which Al-Qaeda has said that they're almost ready to attack the United States and that the plans are actually 90% complete. But he also took pains, as did FBI Director Mueller, to say that there's nothing specific or corroborated as to a time or place or type of attack.
So that comes back to the same question. John Ashcroft said in January, Al-Qaeda announced they were 70% ready for an attack on the United States. In March, after the Madrid bombings, he said they announced they were 90% ready for an attack on the United States. That's right. In March. Now it's the end of May. So, again, the question, if you put on your interpretive hat, you follow these things. Why
right.
Now?
Well, you'd think that they were 100% ready by now. And I must have missed that announcement by Al-Qaeda, and I watched them very, very carefully. He did imply that it was some sort of public announcement.
He did on the web or something.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think that there's been concerns for a long time now that they're going to be planning some type of attack at either one of the conventions or at the G8 summit in Georgia in early June or just before the election in order to stampede people away from voting again for the Bush administration. I happen to know people within the administration that think that if there is an attack before the election that it may actually help President Bush by showing that Al-Qaeda is so concerned about him that they're trying to get him out of office. But clearly, Al-Qaeda is emboldened by the success they had in Madrid, or their affiliates had in Madrid, in which the government was essentially overturned right after an attack, and they pulled their troops out of Iraq.
John Ashcroft indicating today that he believes Al-Qaeda may have drawn from that it could do something similar in the United States. When you talk to independent intelligence analysts, do they look at that as a realistic assessment of how Al-Qaeda might see an opportunity in the coming months?
Oh, absolutely, yes. In fact, bin Laden, I think it was just last month, right about the time that President Bush had embraced Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and his attempts to broker a peace agreement in the West Bank, and Bush supported that, bin Laden took to the airwaves and released another tape in which he clearly said that the Spain attacks were a big success and that Al-Qaeda operatives around the world needed to try to do that more often, to try to sort of inject themselves into the political process and time their attacks to help impact politics and world events.
Now, a nuts and bolts question. Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge said today that there were no plans to change the color-coded terror alert level, which is currently at yellow, the midpoint on their five-point scale. He said on NBC's Today show, right now, there's no need to put the entire country on an elevated national alert. But of course, just a few hours later, that's pretty much what John Ashcroft did. Do we have two sheets of music being played here, or are they saving the alert for a sense of imminent danger?
Well, I think that's what they're doing. I think that, there are many people within the government that really hate the whole alert system and joke about how we need mauve and peach and different gradations of yellow and orange or actually more seriously, different parts of the country specific warnings, because each time you raise the level, it costs literally hundreds of millions of dollars for law enforcement to deploy all the extra resources. But my guess is that they will probably raise it to orange sometime closer to the conventions, perhaps maybe right after July 4th or before July 4th. But you can never really tell exactly what they're going to do that's going to cause them to raise or lower the level. At least I can't.
Let's look at the conventions for a moment. How ripe a target would these actually be? There will be enormous security around them.
Right.
So does that make them a better or worse target for Al-Qaeda?
There's two trains of thought about that as well. I mean, I've been saying this for a long time, so it might be a cliche by now, and other people have as well. But if you end up trying to protect everything, you end up protecting nothing. And I think that there's authorities that are concerned about that. And there's two schools of thought in the sense that one thinks that Al-Qaeda operatives would love to attack a target like the convention or the subway underneath the convention to make a big political statement, while others say that they're going to attack a soft target like a mall or a bar or a baseball game or something where there really aren't a lot of authorities watching for them, just to show people that they can strike wherever they want.
When authorities say, as FBI Director Robert Mueller did today, along with John Ashcroft, we do not know what form the threat might take. We don't know where, we don't know how, we don't know when. As citizens, should we be comforted by that, dismayed by that, or is that just reality?
Well, it is reality. It's somewhat dismaying to me that they don't know, but if they did say they knew, I wouldn't believe that either, because at this point, Al-Qaeda is not a hierarchical organization where you can trace the money and find out who's doing it. It's literally thousands of followers around the world who can act spontaneously or independently whenever they want. When bin Laden now issues a decree saying, you know, attack, nobody knows who could rise up and take the challenge and do it. I mean, it's really, there's no connections. It's become such a flattened, decentralized organization that it's more of an ideology now than anything else, and that makes it almost impossible to find out who might be launching the next attack.
And Ashcroft acknowledging that today, saying it's very flexible, it's very versatile, the face of Al-Qaeda may change, it may be a different kind of operative. Overall, Josh, what's your sense? All this time after 9/11, does the United States have a better leg up on this terror threat or not?
Well, I think you'd have to ask them that. They're very circumspect when they talk about it. I think that they keep saying that they're making headway and that they've arrested or detained or killed a lot of the top Al-Qaeda operatives, but they also are openly conceding that Al-Qaeda has been very smart in developing succession plans so that while you have this separate network out there that's more ideology-based, there is an actual Al-Qaeda network that is intact and operating and doing quite well. On top of that, there's actually three or four different layers of Al-Qaeda they describe it as. So, like they say, it's going to take decades to sort of counter this threat. I think one FBI agent hit the nail on the head when he said, it's like a football analogy, is that they're on the 2-yard line and threatening to score each play, and if we don't stop them, a disaster happens, and if we do stop them, they go back and reset on the 2-yard line and have a chance to do it all over again. So, you know, I don't envy these guys for trying to stop it because they don't know where and when and how it's going to come. It's an almost impossible task.
And, of course, we see bitterly today how terrorism seeps into life, including political life, even without an attack. We had the president of the International Association of Firefighters, Harold Scheitberger, telling reporters that he found the timing of the threat announcement today suspicious because of polls showing a sagging approval rating for President Bush. Of course, this is a group associated with John Kerry. There's a dance around the very warnings, and Kerry himself was speaking out today.
Yeah, I mean, I don't buy that they did this today because of the polls about Iraq. I mean, there are people that are somewhat cynical that say that they're issuing this kind of vague warning just to cover themselves in case anything does happen. That way they can say, well, we warned you. But I think part of it is that they're really just concerned enough to ask the public's help in finding some people. But it is interesting that John Kerry, the presumptive nominee for the Democrats, is talking about it as well. I think he's been saying over the last few days that the Bush administration has failed in terms of protecting the ports and the harbors and the borders and allowing terrorists to get into the country. So it'll be interesting to hear how he would plan to fix that problem, because it's a fairly intractable problem.
Well, a very big new warning today. We will see where it goes. Josh Meyer, thank you so much for being with us.
You're very welcome.
Josh Meyer covers intelligence for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke with us from Washington following the high-profile warning from Washington today. All eyes were on Boston and New York City, the two cities hosting the Democratic and Republican national conventions this summer. Boston will host the Democrats at the Fleet Center Sports Arena in downtown Boston from July 26th to the 29th. New York hosts the GOP at Madison Square Garden from August 30th to September 2nd. Joining me now to talk about how word of today's terror warning is being received in Boston and New York are Fred Tice, reporter for WBUR in Boston. Welcome, Fred.
Thank you, Tom.
And Rocco Parascandola, staff writer at Newsday in New York. Good evening and welcome, Rocco.
Hello, how are you?
Fine. Rocco, first to you, if we could. Big warning from John Ashcroft and Robert Mueller. Is New York taking it in stride, or is the city on pins and needles that it might, you know, feel something it's felt before on 9/11/2001 when the Republicans come to town?
Well, I mean, we've been on orange alert for so long now that it almost seems like everyone is sort of taking it in stride. The reality is that NYPD has been doing just about everything it could in terms of trying to prevent an attack, to train its officers to respond to an attack, to patrol around landmark buildings and hotels in the financial district and the UN and St. Patrick's Cathedral, et cetera, that when an alert like this happens, it doesn't seem to raise the concern level anymore, because I think we're about as high on alert, I think it can be.
And yet,
and it doesn't seem to even make, in terms of the media, the headlines that you see following an announcement like this, I think play out in larger type, so to speak, in other cities than it does in some of the bigger cities, including New York.
Maybe New York is just that big, and yet it took a heck of a blow almost 3 years ago now. Nobody would want to see that happen again. Fred Tice, what about in Boston? How are people interpreting this? We heard the first reaction this morning saying nothing specifically targeted at Boston, but yet here's John Ashcroft saying, look, it happened in Madrid. It affected their elections there. It could happen here. And essentially naming these two conventions as opportunities for that. Is it going to be an act of courage to attend a political nominating convention this summer?
The officials here in Boston, including the head of the FBI here and the U.S. attorney here in Boston, both say there's no specific credible evidence. They repeated that again this afternoon, that Boston is a target. However, U.S. attorney Michael Sullivan did say you've got to look at a convention as a more likely target than somewhere else in the country.
And fine. And meanwhile, no specific credible evidence, but you've got the attorney general saying, right or wrong, that there's a great danger, so great we've come out here to tell you about it today.
While the officials say there's no specific danger, it's important for people who don't live in Boston to understand that this is a city that seems already fed up with the convention 2 months before it's even begun.
Fred, describe for us, if you would, the extent of security arrangements in place for Boston. It is quite incredible. If you look at a map, all the roads are going to be closed for this convention, being held at a sports arena 40 feet from a major underground highway.
And that is the reason why every single interstate into the city will be closed. Imagine that, from 4 p.m. on till the end of the evening, usually conventions end at
for how many days?
Midnight, for four nights straight.
At a major American city, every interstate closed.
Every major interstate, and some of the parkways that head into the city too. The parking lots all over downtown, the surface parking lots, will all be off limits.
So battened down like nobody's business.
People are told to telecommute, to take vacations, but they're always told that. I mean, I think people were really shocked this week when they heard from the Secret Service the extent of the security arrangements.
And it's kind of lockdown.
Because the interstate goes 40 feet away from the Fleet Center, the sports arena where the convention will be. The Secret Service requirements are that highways or any point where you might have a bomb be at least 600 feet away. And the other problem is that here, unlike in New York, the railroad station at the Fleet Center is very, very shallow. In New York,
not deep
Madison
underground
Square
here.
It's much deeper. Yeah.
Rocco, you've got the Madison Square Garden sitting right on top of Penn Station. Is that of concern? Are the subways going to keep running right under the convention in New York?
Well, both the mayor and the police commissioner have been adamant in reiterating that they have no intention of closing Penn Station, and there are roughly a dozen subway and suburban commuter lines that run into and through Penn Station. They have held out the possibility that they may close it during the time when President Bush is speaking, but unless there's an actual specific threat between now and then, the plan is to keep Penn Station open.
Well, these two cities essentially named as targets today by the U.S. Attorney General and head of the FBI. Quite a remarkable and sad situation. Rocco Parascandola in New York City with Newsday. Thanks so much for joining us.
Very welcome.
And Fred Tice with WBUR here in Boston. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks,
Fred,
for asking.
Listeners, we are talking tonight about terror alarms and the November election, the big and horrible what-if scenario. What if the presidential contest is rocked by a terror attack? Have you run the movie in your own mind, Terror in the Streets on the Eve of the Election? How does this movie end? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about terror alarms and the November election, the big and horrible what-if scenario. What if the presidential contest is rocked by a terror attack? You can join our conversation tonight. John Ashcroft and Robert Mueller say the threat is real. Do you believe it? How could we not believe it? And how deep would the wound be of an election clouded by terror, fear, by terror itself? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight from Washington by David Rothkopf, a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. His article, Bombs and Ballots, appeared in the Washington Post recently. Good evening and welcome, David Rothkopf.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks for joining us. And with me in the studio tonight, our own On Point news analyst, Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, great to have you here.
Nice to be here, Tom.
David Rothkopf, you have written, and some months ago now, ahead of the curve, I'd say, a kind of scenario for Election Day 2004 that concerned you then and no doubt concerns you now. Paint a picture for us of what you fear Americans might have to face.
Well, I think that they face the likelihood of an attack, and I think that it's likely that that attack will be very disruptive and will have tragic consequences. Naturally, I fear that, but I think that is of greater concern to me and to all of us is that in the wake of such an attack, our sort of rational processes as a nation will be disrupted, that you may have a kind of quasi-martial law at the time of an election, or that you may have a massive swing in the vote one direction or another because of emotion rather than a rational assessment of what our needs are. We live in an era in which terrorism is a day-to-day reality, and while we try to harden the physical assets of our country, the most important assets for us to harden in order to be able to prepare for this are our psychological assets.
And that we're going to dig into tonight. Helping us do that, I want to welcome from Washington also David Sanger, White House reporter with the New York Times. Good evening and welcome, David Sanger.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks for being with us. David, two questions to you, jumping off David Rothkopf's comments. A, how much are Washington politicos and security officials thinking about this threat to in a presidential election season, to the presidential race and election itself now? And what kind of calculations are going on about what the impact might be if such an attack would hit the United States badly in the run-up to the election?
Well, I think David was just right. It was exactly right when he said that, you know, the biggest thing one needs to steal here is our psychological preparedness for this. This was described to me today by somebody at the White House as a continuation of those comments that you heard Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor, and President Bush make earlier this year when they said that they feared that there could be an attack that would seek to influence the presidential election. Now, this could go any number of ways, and there are all kinds of theories that have been gamed out by both campaigns about what would happen if there was an attack. Would there be an immediate rallying behind the president? There probably would be. Would it last as long as it did after September 11th? The theory is, and of course nobody knows the answer to this, that it might not. That the second time around, one would ask a lot of questions a lot earlier about homeland security and preparedness. So nobody really knows how this could play out. It's something that neither campaign wants to be experimenting with.
And yet they've got to be thinking about it.
They are. And, you know, when you talk to people who are inside the campaigns, they will describe to you their theories at great length, but they can't really admit publicly to doing so.
You've written that both campaigns, Bush and Kerry, actually obsess in private about this very threat.
They do. They do, because when you think about it, this is the great imponderable, or one of the great imponderables, Iraq being the second, of the campaign. We think we know, we could be in for a surprise, but we think we know roughly where the economy is headed for the next 5 months, because economies don't change that rapidly. And things have gradually been improving. And
it looks like not a bad path.
Probably not a bad path. So that leaves what things will look like in Iraq before and after June 30th, and what the domestic terrorism scene is like.
And what did you make of the timing today? The same day that the New York Times is leading with the story of abuse of prisoners, torture of prisoners being much more widespread than the president acknowledged just Monday night at the Army War College, suddenly here comes this press conference. I don't know. How do you interpret the timing? Is this just good, prudent government warning to the citizenry of the nation or something else?
You know, I'm crummy at figuring out motive here. I'm probably not a good enough political reporter to know that. On the one hand, it is the beginning of the summer season traditionally with Memorial Day. They've got a bunch of big events coming up, starting with the G8 meeting in Sea Island, Georgia, which is right after the president's brief trip to Europe.
And even sooner with the World War II Memorial on the Mall in Washington
that's being christened
this weekend.
That's right. That's this Saturday. So they're going to have, hundreds of thousands of people on the Mall on Saturday. Then the G8. Then the president's in Istanbul just before the handover for a NATO summit meeting. So they've got a lot of big events coming up that they're naturally worried about. And, of course, the Olympics this summer.
Right. Jack Beatty, here we sit, an election now a handful of months away, an election following a disputed election in the year 2000. I mean, can you imagine how deeply unsettling, how wounding, if somehow terror shows up in these next months in a way that people believe influences in an untoward manner, whatever that might be, the outcome of this election? I mean, what a picture that would leave.
You talk about being under a cloud. Yes, the event, as David said, is imponderable. What worries me more is fear about the event, the anticipation of it. And that, I think, is a political emotion. And I think it is susceptible to manipulation. Mm. And I think John Ashcroft is just the man to manipulate it. What do we know about him? We know that 42 senators, an unprecedented amount, voted against him, a former colleague. Why? Because in the words of Dick Durbin of Illinois, he lied to us about a judicial candidate that was turned down for federal judge.
Before he lost the Senate race in Missouri and was put up for attorney general by
George
Bush.
We know from the September 11th hearings that he smeared Jamie Gorelick. He put out a statement about her having built this wall. It turned out it was entirely a smear. It was far more complicated.
The wall between FBI and
that's
CIA
right, that's
and
right.
justice.
And she had death threats against her children. And we know from that testimony that he had a direct contradiction with the acting head of the FBI at that time, whose name I forget. But it looked to me, I mean, the FBI guy had no reason to lie about what he said, which was that Ashcroft blew off threats of terrorism, and Ashcroft had every reason to lie. So we have a very political attorney general whose credibility is our 42 senators didn't think it for much of it. And he's got this button in his hand, and we are all susceptible to this kind of fear. And my fear about the fear is that it essentially it is a kind of, don't make any changes. Keep things stable.
Stay the course
stay
with
the
this
course.
President. But, Jack, to be fair, Madrid happened. It happened on the eve of an election there. It swayed that election very dramatically. Al-Qaeda, at least if John Ashcroft is telling it straight, is saying it wants to come after the United States. Isn't it important from another perspective for the country, as David Sanger says, to steel itself for this possibility so that it's not just in a complete tizzy fit if it should happen?
Yes, it is. It certainly is. But we also have to say, why are we in this situation? Today, the International Institute of Strategic Studies in London put out a report saying that the occupation of Iraq, quote, has provided a potent global recruitment pretext for al-Qaeda. In effect, we have been made less secure by this occupation and are being made less secure every day. So this isn't happening in a vacuum, this sort of terror fright. It's all over the world, 18,000 new recruits. So, we have a lot to be afraid about.
David Rothkopf, you raised, as David Sanger did as well, the psychological impact. Now we have two things on the table. One, the possibility of an attack. And I think from a security perspective, no one can deny that possibility sits there. Surveys show a lot of Americans think it's certainly a serious possibility. There's also the possibility, we can't deny it, of manipulation of that threat. How do you see the psychological impact of each of these? Let's start with manipulation, even if there's no attack.
Well, I don't think the public's going to react terribly well to being manipulated, and I think the public's a little bit more attuned to these kind of issues. You know, you recall the end of the Clinton administration when the Lewinsky scandals took place. There are a number of international incidents and stories abounded about wagging the dog. And so people are aware when politicians are trying to play them.
Really? Really? Even today? I mean, anybody who saw the towers come down in New York, it's hard to just shrug when John Ashcroft says what he said today and said, manipulation.
I don't think that people are so unsophisticated as to listen to somebody like John Ashcroft or George Bush or John Kerry who have a clear motive, a clear objective that dominates their lives. And when they speak, not ask, why are they saying what they're saying?
So there'll be some discounting there, you're saying.
Well, I think that there has to be. I think, you know, when I wrote this article six, seven months ago, I looked at probably about a dozen cases around the world where this took place. In every single case, the attack cut to the benefit of the incumbent because there was an automatic nationalistic impulse.
Mm-hmm.
However, then Spain took place. And the Spanish attack played right into the hands of the terrorists because 90% of the Spanish people were already predisposed against Iraq, and this allowed them to express that within days at the election booth. Now, there are a couple of scenarios here which could take place. If an attack took place very close to the election and there weren't much time for deliberation about it.
As David Sanger says,
As David said, I think it's highly likely it would cut for the president. If it were a couple of months beforehand and there were a clear connection between the attack and, say, Iraq, then it's going to cut against the president. So timing, location, context will all make a difference in how it is interpreted. And that's going to be, you know, the kind of debate that's going to take place in its immediate aftermath.
David,
can I add one point to David's very good point here?
Yes.
I also think the type of attack might make a difference in how it is interpreted, because there are some things which I think the public would view as attacks that you simply can't prevent against. You know, the equivalent of a suicide bomber in Jerusalem, you know, if that happened in the United States, it's something that's very hard to stop. On the other hand, if there is an attack, God forbid any of this should happen, but of a type where the new Department of Homeland Security was supposed to be cracking down, you know, cargo ships, something we hear a lot about, I think that would, if there was sufficient time, lead to all the natural questions of why did this set of measures or that set of measures fail? Was enough done?
So what does it say about the efficacy of Bush administration measures? But where do you draw the line between those two, David? I mean, a single suicide bomber, very tough to stop. A freighter in Boston or New York Harbor that blows, tougher. But what about a truck full of explosives in a tunnel somewhere? Stoppable, not stoppable? Where's the line?
You know, hard to tell, and it's going to depend, as David said, on both timing and manner. And, you know, we hope that we don't have to address almost any of these. But you asked before why the campaigns were obsessed with it. Mm. They're obsessed with it because they're doing a more sophisticated, detailed version of what we've briefly run through here tonight.
And doing it very actively, as you describe it. I want to invite our callers in. Scott's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have to agree with Jack Beatty to a large extent. And question, you know, is Ashcroft the Attorney General of the United States, or is he the Al-Qaeda press secretary?
What do you mean by Al-Qaeda press secretary?
He's not really presenting new knowledge. You know, as someone earlier pointed out, there's been some intelligence since January. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that the biggest targets are going to be the major political events of the summer. As Jack said, it does sound to me suspiciously like beating the drum of political hysteria in order to benefit the Bush administration possibly.
And you're saying it then at the same time, in a way, the U.S. Attorney General is a megaphone for Al-Qaeda.
Right, exactly. I mean, fear itself is the attack.
But would it be responsible for the U.S. government not to get Americans thinking about this if this might drop on us like a ton of bricks in such a critical season? Isn't it incumbent on the government to say, Americans, think about this, it's a real possibility?
Well, it cuts both ways because, as I said, fear itself is the attack. It isn't the substance of whatever event happens so much as the fear and the anticipation beforehand that might be much more politically malleable than the actual event itself.
Scott, we've got it. David Sanger, let me put that to you. you know the ways in which this could cut for the incumbent. Is this administration, by its nature, its character, capable of resisting working those pedals?
You know, I don't know if they're capable of it, and, you know, one would assume that into everything in a political season goes a political calculation. But I don't think the calculation here is that difficult to suss out. I mean, it was just 2 months ago, month and a half ago, that we were wrapped up in the 9/11 investigation and trying to discuss the PDB, the Presidential Daily Brief that the
right.
President was given on August 6, 2001,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
just a month and a few days before the September 11th attacks. And what did that brief, what was missing from that brief? Any real assessment of a risk in the United States. If you read it, you saw all the risks seem to be abroad. What happened today? They went out and emphasized the threats that are here in the U.S., although they acknowledged that some of the threats could be to U.S. interests abroad.
It was a mention, yeah.
So I think there is a degree here of inoculation that they don't want to be caught out a second time if something happened here. If nothing happens here, nobody's going to blame them for issuing the warning, I think they figure, and probably nobody will even remember it. I mean, how many warnings have we been through since September 11th that fortunately turned out to be unneeded.
Yet this was different in kind today. There was no bumping up of the terror alert level, the color bar, and there is this question, John Ashcroft himself saying Al-Qaeda said 70% ready for an attack on the U.S. in January, 90% in March. Well, here we are. It's almost June. Why today, Mr. Ashcroft? David Rothkopf, what's your assessment of this government's self-control, ability to resist working the potential fear factor here?
Well, I think they have to walk a tightrope, but the reality, you know, I think you said it, was that, you know, we're on the beginning of the summer season, we're on the beginning of the season where these things are most likely, and they received a lot of criticism earlier for not having brought these things up prior to 9/11. I think there's a sort of corollary set of issues here, which we haven't been asking, which is, have the policies of the Bush administration actually made us safer? And I think there's a consensus among experts who studied Homeland Security that the creation of a Department of Homeland Security has not necessarily done that. It's created a big bureaucracy that's still trying to coalesce, and that going into Iraq not only distracted us from the pursuit of Al-Qaeda, but has now led to these kind of large recruits that your friend in the studio there has cited, and which is actually spreading this problem. Now, having said that, I believe the Bush administration has actually made things more dangerous in terms of terrorism. The reality is, this is a real risk. And whereas fear is the terrorist tool, preparedness is our ally.
But of course, as David Sanger says, if it happened in enough time, as you're pointing out, it might actually work to John Kerry's favor if Americans decided not enough had been done. David Sanger, I know we have to let you go. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
David Sanger, White House reporter for the New York Times. We're talking tonight about terror alarms and the November election. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about terror alarms and the November presidential election, the big and horrible what-if scenario. What if the presidential contest is rocked by a terror attack? You can join us tonight. It's a terrible calculus, but who gains and who loses from a terror attack before November 2nd? Does George Bush win as a symbol of resolve? Does John Kerry win as a symbol of a better way? Does Osama bin Laden win either way? How might an attack hit your psyche, your vote? Can you believe we're having to have this conversation? Will Americans keep their heads in this campaign, come what may? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined from Washington tonight by David Rothkopf, visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. In the studio with me tonight, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, and with us right now from Bethesda, Maryland, Gerald Post. He is director of the Political Psychology Program at George Washington University. He's founder and former director of the CIA Center for the Analysis of Personality and Political Behavior. Good evening and welcome, Gerald Post.
Welcome to you. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us, Gerald Post. You've thought about this a good deal. If, at two levels, help us understand psychologically, A, the simple threat of a terror attack now articulated by the Attorney General, and B, the impact on an electorate of an actual attack. How does the rock splash in the pond?
Well, let me begin back in Madrid for a moment, because there was an attack on the eve of an election which clearly determined the election results. And how we might react rather differs from lessons learned by the terrorists there, and I think it's quite conceivable and probable that, A, they were highly empowered by this.
Because the electorate was swung away from a conservative government to a government opposed to the war in Iraq, and Spain's troops are now out of Iraq.
Right, and would they somehow extrapolate from what happened there to the United States? At a minimum, it would certainly argue for an increased likelihood of attempting, with a feeling of headiness, a similar event designed to destabilize the electorate on the eve of the election in the United States.
But are you saying in that al-Qaeda could imagine, might imagine, or that attack on the United States would get the United States to turn tail in Iraq and get out of there?
No. Mm-hmm. That they could not get us to turn tail, but could indeed have a significant impact on the electorate, as they did in Spain.
But to what end, if not leaving Iraq? To what end?
Well, I'm not sure they'd go beyond that in their thinking.
You mean it's enough to shake the populace, to shake the electorate, I should say.
But, in fact, and I was not present in the earlier discussion, but certainly many would believe that, in fact, it might well lead to a rally around the flag reaction for the incumbent, which might not be part of the calculus, however, of Bin Laden and company.
Jack Beatty, let me put that to you. I mean, as impossible as it is to put oneself in the shoes of al-Qaeda, but is it clear to you that al-Qaeda's wish in an attack, if an attack were to come, would be to shake George Bush out of the White House? Or, given the recruiting numbers that you cited there, are they happier to have him in the White House?
Well, Richard Clark said that he sometimes thought that George Bush was channeling Osama bin Laden in getting us into Iraq.
Richard Clark, the former security
advisor.
That's
right. That's right. And he felt that in some strange way we were doing exactly what bin Laden wanted, putting a Christian, quote-unquote, army into the middle of a Muslim country at a time when at a time of international terrorism based on fanatical Islamist beliefs in some part. It seems to me that if they have a candidate, and I'm not, this sounds like a terrible thing to say, but I just, based on what Clark just said, it seems to me their candidate would be Bush to intensify the contradictions, as the Marxists used to say. The Marxists always wanted the conservative parties to win, or, you know, the ones that were most against them, so that they would intensify the contradictions, make things worse.
David Rothkopf, this gets very quickly into very, very tangled and hyper-speculative. We all acknowledge that. But how do you see it, David, in terms of the American electorate's response? At some level, I assume the electorate's going to want to do whatever it thinks al-Qaeda doesn't want it to do after an attack.
Well, I don't think the electorate's going to think about this in terms of al-Qaeda. I think they're going to think about this in terms of themselves. And I think what they're going to want is to be more secure. And I think that they're going to ultimately act, you know, in the direction of the candidate who seems like they're going to be toughest on terrorism. If it appears that Bush has distracted us from the real mission against al-Qaeda, or if it appears that Bush has, as Jack was just saying, inflamed the terrorists, and that's a case that's going to be made by outside observers, this might cut against them. If John Kerry begins to effectively make the message, and I think that he's starting to do that actually just this week, but if he begins to effectively make the message, listen, America, I am actually going to be tougher on terrorism than George Bush. I am going to be more focused on the real goals than George Bush, and I'm going to build an alliance with our allies more effectively than he did, and thus be able to fight this better. He could use that as a springboard. But at the end of the day, it's the gut issue in an American as to whether or not they're going to feel more safe with one guy than with the other guy.
Michael is calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Yes, good evening.
Good evening.
My thoughts are that if an attack were to occur as we're approaching Election Day,
yes,
perhaps within weeks of November, if both candidates are mature enough in placing the interests of America before their own personal and party interests, they might get together and make a joint statement to all of the country to get out, vote, but vote the way they would have before the attack, as if it never happened.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a tall thing to ask if there's been a serious attack, but you're saying steady the country, say, don't act just on the basis of alarm and panic.
Exactly, and it would be really acting in the best interest of the country overall as opposed to either party's best interest.
Michael, there's a kind of wisdom in that I'm trying to get my hands around. I thank you for that call. Jack Beatty, the whole impetus for our show tonight is at some level related to this, to say, dear fellow citizens, this could happen. Never mind the timing of it, of this warning or that happened, but obviously this could happen. Mm-hmm. So steady yourself now, as David Sanger said, steel your psyche now. Think about how you might take it on board so that you're not voting in a tizzy.
So that you won't be stampeded.
Won't yeah. be stampeded one yeah. way or another,
one
whatever
or another.
That might be to you.
Yeah, yeah. I think it would be. I mean, I can imagine candidates making such a statement, but inevitably it would have a politics, either a politics of fear, which could go in the direction of Bush, steady, we're going to stay with what we have,
yep.
or a politics of rejection, of a feeling that Bush had failed, that this was a preventable attack, and that he was distracted.
Gerald Post, we just have half a minute left, just literally 30 seconds. Is a stampede a likely outcome of an attack, or is the electorate more steady than that?
I wouldn't anticipate a stampede, but I must say I would like to point out it wouldn't take a super terrorist effect to have a very large super terrorist attack to have a large effect, because we have such a sensitized population. Even some bombs at some shopping malls could have really a very huge disproportionate effect.
It is damnably easy to do, and what a tale would be told then. Gerald Post, director of this political psychology program at George Washington University, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
And David Rothkopf, visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Jack, here we are. A place we don't want to be, but there's no choice but put one foot in front of the other. Try and keep clear heads.
And remember FDR, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Well, I'm for that. And batten down the hatches a little bit. Jack, thanks for being with us tonight. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a new Amnesty International report criticizes the United States for human rights abuses. This is On Point. Two new reports, one from the U.S. Army itself and the other from Amnesty International, raise questions about human rights abuses by American forces in Iraq and Afghanistan. The Army survey shows abuse of prisoners in American custody in Iraq and Afghanistan is more widespread and involves more military units than had previously been known. A second report, this one by Amnesty International, condemns the United States for carrying out a war on terror it says is flouting human rights in a failed attempt to gain security. White House spokesman Scott McClellan responded that the United States is a leader on human rights and said that the war on terror has protected the human rights of 25 million people in Afghanistan and another 25 million in Iraq. But in presenting the report from Amnesty earlier today in Washington, Amnesty USA Executive Director William Schultz said the world's human rights situation is worse than it's been in 50 years, and charged that the Bush administration's war on terror had actually made the world a more unsafe place. Here is an excerpt from William Schultz's presentation.
The shameful prisoner abuse scandal, the unlawful killing of civilians by coalition troops in Iraq, the indefinite incommunicado detention of prisoners at Guantanamo Bay and the Patriot Act's attacks on civil rights protections demonstrate the Bush administration's blind pursuit of security at all costs. President Bush said in his State of the Union address this year, "As we gather tonight, hundreds of thousands of American servicemen and women are deployed across the world in the war on terror. By bringing hope to the oppressed and delivering justice to the violent, they are making America more secure." Well, make no mistake about it, living free from violence is indeed a basic human right. The U.S. government has an obligation to protect the security of its people. And the brave men and women in the United States Armed Forces who daily put their lives at risk deserve our gratitude. We believe that the vast majority of U.S. soldiers act with integrity and are as appalled at the horrific abuses committed at Abu Ghraib prison as the rest of the world is. But to President Bush's claim that the war on terror is making the world safer, we say that he is sadly mistaken. The administration's war on terror is bankrupt of vision and bereft of principle, and it has made the world a far more dangerous place. And this is not mere rhetoric. As reported in the June issue of the Atlantic Monthly, Mark Sageman, a counterterrorism advisor to the U.S. government, has found that al-Qaeda has committed nearly twice as many terrorist acts since September 11th than in its entire five-year history before the advent of the war on terror. In a recent survey of scholars at leading universities and prominent think tanks who are experts on terrorism, Amnesty International USA found that 80% of them believe that the war on terror has not made the world safer. And Amnesty International's own research shows that the number of armed groups has risen by 17% from the two-year period prior to September 11th to the two-year period following. It is clear that the way in which the war on terror is being conducted today is not making us safer. To put it as simply as possible, it is, in fact, a failure. It is making the world more dangerous. And by relying on force alone, the U.S. government has sacrificed one of its major weapons in the struggle against terrorism, namely its own reputation as an exemplar of human rights. In the same State of the Union address, President Bush said, "Words must be credible, and no one can now doubt the word of America." Well, even if those words were true then, they certainly are not true today. Who now will not doubt the U.S. government when it says that it will uphold human rights and the rule of law? The government's conduct of the war on terror has given the world evidence of its hypocrisy and emboldened extremists to strike at American targets and civilians. The Bush administration has lost its moral compass at a time when violations are rising around the globe.
William Schultz, Executive Director of Amnesty International USA, he spoke earlier today in Washington at the release of Amnesty International's 2004 Human Rights Report. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.